Yeah, that makes sense. I just washed my hands. I'll be back in 2 seconds.
20 seconds, actually, Galen.
That was some good shaming, Nathaniel.
Oops.
Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk. Joe Biden swept another round of primaries on Tuesday night with wins in Florida, Illinois, and Arizona. So for all intents and purposes, the Democratic primary is over, barring some crazy unforeseen circumstance outside the scope of our model. That's been clear, though, for a week now. So we're going to dig into some of the results of Tuesday night. But what we really want to focus on today's podcast is the effect that COVID-19 had on these elections. Did people turn out? What was the process like for in-person voting? And of course, we know that Ohio has postponed its in-person voting until June. And that's still an ongoing legal process, so we'll find out exactly what happens, but we're going to get into some of that saga. So here with me to cover that, our senior writer, Amelia Thompson DeVoe. Hey, Amelia, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Galen?
You know, best as I can be these days.
I know. I keep asking people that question when I do interviews and then immediately apologizing because nobody is okay right now.
Maybe it's more like, how are you holding up?
I like that.
All right. And Amelia is based out of Chicago, and you spent part of the day yesterday speaking with primary voters about voting amid the coronavirus. So I look forward to hearing about that. And also here with us is elections analyst Nathaniel Rakich. Hi, Nathaniel. How are you holding up?
Hey, Galen. I'm pretty good. You know, my life is basically staying in because I work from home, and then on the weekends, I don't have a social life. So things haven't changed that much for me. I guess I'm kind of lucky.
Good to hear. Good to hear. And Nathaniel, you've been tracking the effects of the virus on voting across the country with cancellations and delays. So let's begin somewhat broadly. Were Tuesday night's results in line with what we expected based on pre-election polling? In other words, were there any aberrations in the overall results that would make you think that the pandemic is having an impact on who won last night's primaries?
The short answer is the results were basically as we expected. You know, these were supposed to be some of Joe Biden's best states, especially Florida, and he did indeed win them all by double digits. In a couple of them, like Arizona and Illinois, it looks like the margin is maybe a little bit tighter than we thought it was going to be, but certainly nothing enough that you would say, oh my gosh, Bernie Sanders is now in the national lead, which he would need to be by quite a significant margin in order to overtake Biden and his delegate lead at some point.
What were the results? For a moment, forgetting the coronavirus, how would you characterize the results? Was it a blowout, a landslide?
Yeah, so in Florida, Joe Biden won by almost 40 points, 62% to 23%. In Illinois, Biden won 59% to 36%, so a little bit narrower than Florida. And in Arizona, although there's lots of votes still to count there, Biden won 44% to 32%, so a little bit more than a 10-point margin. So a blowout in Florida for sure. It was a little bit closer in Arizona, but you know, again, I don't think anybody is saying that Bernie Sanders had a good night because he overperformed a bit from his polls in Arizona.
Amelia, what was turnout like yesterday?
In Illinois, turnout was pretty low. And there was also just kind of, you know, like early voting was up. A lot of people voted early. There was a record number of applications for vote by mail ballots. They had state officials had extended the deadline to request a vote by mail ballot. And it seemed like a lot of people took advantage of that. And so for day of voting, turnout was especially low, especially where I am here in Chicago in Cook County. That does not mean that people were not waiting in lines and encountering various problems. We can talk about that more later. But in general, I mean, I think it's a little hard to say, were people staying home because of COVID-19 fears? Were they staying home because, you know, as you said at the top of the podcast, it seemed like last week, you know, the Democratic primary kind of ceased to be competitive. I think that's a little harder to say, but certainly it seemed like in Illinois, at least, fewer people were coming out to vote.
In Florida, you saw the same thing, except the turnout levels stayed a little bit steadier. So I crunched the numbers late last night. These might be a little bit out of date now, but more than 650,000 Democrats did mail voting, which was a 27% increase from 2016 in Florida. And more than 400,000 Democrats voted early, which was a 19% increase. However, only about 500,000 Democrats voted on Election Day itself, which is a 40% decrease. So it looks like certainly in Florida and anecdotally from Illinois, it looks like people were swapping out voting in person for voting early. In Illinois, because there isn't as much of a culture of early voting, that led to a pretty substantial decrease in turnout from 2016. In 2016, the turnout rate in Illinois was 23%, and this year it was 17% based on preliminary numbers. Turnout was basically flat in Florida, however, because there are those robust mail and early voting options.
Is it clear that, can we come to the conclusion that turnout was lower because of concerns about coronavirus? As you mentioned, Amelia, there's that tension between the race no longer being competitive and coronavirus as well. Like, how do you parse that, Nathaniel?
Yeah, I mean, you can never, you know, prove for sure because correlation isn't causation, but I think that is certainly a very strong theory, given that the state that had more robust early voting, mail voting options saw turnout basically stay the same, whereas the state where those options were more limited saw a strong decrease in turnout.
There was some talk leading up to these primaries that older voters might be more concerned about the spread of the virus and their own personal risks, and therefore possibly turn out at lower numbers. Did we see any of that?
So I can say anecdotally that I saw plenty of elderly people coming out to vote. I think there was just generally a pretty good age mix in the people I talked to. I went around to a couple of precincts in my neighborhood here in Chicago and to an early voting site. I talked to one woman who's 81 years old and said she just really likes voting in person. And she thought, you know, I'll come mid-morning, I'll bring my hand sanitizer, I'll stay away from people, and I'll be fine. And at that particular location, when we were there, the poll workers did outnumber the voters. So, you know, I think she was correct that it was not that crowded, but these are still sort of pretty small rooms. The voting machines are kind of lined up right next to each other. So you are inevitably in kind of close quarters with each other. And, you know, that sort of age spread, this survey that I'm about to cite wasn't specifically about voting, but there was a Kaiser Family Foundation survey that was released yesterday. It was asking a bunch of questions about precautions that people were taking about the coronavirus, how worried people were. And when they were asking about sort of different precautions, different ways that people are changing their life in response to fears about the coronavirus, it was pretty evenly spread out, even among people who are in these higher risk categories. So folks who are older, folks who have chronic conditions, they really weren't much more likely than people who are younger or in lower risk categories for other reasons to say that they're taking precautions. And that is certainly what I saw on the ground in Chicago. Lots of people just like voting in person. And I think, you know, those people may also tend to be older just because, especially in Illinois, as Nathaniel was saying, vote by mail is not necessarily part of the culture. And it's a sort of newer thing for people. They may not have realized it was an option. Yeah. So I think at least a fair number of older folks were turning out in Chicago.
Beyond the elderly vote in Illinois or across the country, what was voting like yesterday? What kinds of complications do you see?
So here in Chicago, one of the issues was that starting last week, some polling places and precincts started getting shut down. And that was either because they were in nursing homes or retirement facilities where, you know, for obvious reasons, they didn't want to have a lot of foot traffic going through at a time when those places are at much higher risk for people getting coronavirus and the coronavirus spreading. Other polling places closed for other reasons. The place where I vote typically is just the lobby of an apartment building, and that was closed. I think a lot of places were just sort of feeling concerned about having people in and out all day. And what happened as a result was that some of those cancellations happened last week, and so the city was able to adjust. But the cancellations were rolling in through Sunday and Monday. And that meant that people were just getting routed to early voting sites, which were staying open. They weren't actually supposed to be open, but they were staying open at the request of election officials to help sort of be a backstop because of all these cancellations. And there were just huge lines at these early voting facilities. So I went to one that was at a local police station near Wrigley Field. The line was stretching all the way around the building, down the block, around the corner, into the block north of it. It was a really, really long line.
Were people distancing themselves from each other?
So it was funny. The poll workers kept coming out periodically and saying, you guys need to stand, you know, 6 feet away from each other. Some people were really abiding by that. Other people kept forgetting. I don't think it was, you know, that anyone was resistant to the distancing. But one woman said to me, you know, it's just not instinct yet. And I keep forgetting. And, you know, when you're out there for hours and you just get bored and you sort of space out, you forget. Anyway, so there was some variation in the amount of social distancing that I saw in the line, but there, you know, people were trying to abide by it. But, you know, it's just, I just talked to a lot of people who said, I went to my normal polling place. It was closed. Some of them said there was a sign telling them where to go. Some of them, there was no sign. And so they ended up in this really long line. And I think it was not as bad as it could have been because for Chicago, you know, it was relatively okay weather. It wasn't that cold. It was sunny. If it had been raining, I think more people would have gone home. But, you know, I think people were pretty stunned by just how sort of the election infrastructure seemed to not be adjusting to what's been happening.
What did people think about the idea of holding an election amid a pandemic? Were people concerned about being at risk of catching the virus because they were voting? Was anybody upset that the election had gone forward or happy?
Yeah, so I asked a bunch of people this question, and I got really mixed results. Some people were really angry that the state of Illinois had gone ahead with the election, and they said, you know, they're putting people at danger. We should have postponed it. I feel really uncomfortable with this. I don't think this election is important enough to, you know, be potentially endangering people's lives by asking them to come out. Other people had a very strong reaction in the other direction and were saying, you know, it sets a very bad precedent if we start rescheduling elections. Some people said, you know, this is tantamount to voter suppression. I ran into a local alderman outside the police station where the early voting site was, and he was saying, you know, it's just a really hard call. His response was kind of like, it, you know, time will tell. There were risks either way, and we're going to learn from what happened in Illinois whether it's a good idea to actually have elections under these circumstances. I think certainly what happened in Illinois showed the difficulty of adjusting to a reality where it's, you know, dangerous for people to do a lot of the things that you have to do when you go out to vote in our system.
I just add that, some of Amelia's reporting from yesterday was stunning and crazy. But I thought it was interesting that you didn't see the same kind of reports out of Arizona and very few of them out of Florida. And of course, you know, maybe it's because those states, you know, have a majority even of people voting by mail. And so the polling places themselves could be a little bit calmer.
I also want to talk about Ohio and the fiasco that went down there. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Upstart. Upstart knows you're more than just your credit score, and they offer smarter interest rates to help you pay off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional credit score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter rate. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate. And the best part, once the loan is approved and accepted, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 400,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards or meet their financial goals. So free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is top-ranked in their category with a 4.9 out of 5 rating on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. That's upstart.com/politics. Today's podcast is also brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. And that place is ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job sites, but they don't stop there. With powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. You can even add screening questions to your job listing so you can filter candidates and focus on the best ones. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, to try ZipRecruiter for free, listeners can go to ZipRecruiter.com/538. That's ZipRecruiter.com/538. The numbers, not the letters. ZipRecruiter.com/538. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Let's continue with our conversation. Ohio was supposed to vote yesterday, but its election was postponed. And we discussed the mess briefly on this podcast on Monday, but it wasn't fully sorted out then. And Nathaniel, you've been tracking what's happening there. So start from the beginning. What exactly is happening with the Ohio election?
On Monday afternoon, the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, said that he would like to postpone the election due to the new CDC guidelines, which, you know, in fairness, are changing all the time with smaller and smaller gatherings being allowed. And he wanted to postpone the election to June 2nd. However, the governor does not have the unilateral authority to do that in Ohio. So he had to get some private citizens essentially to sue in order to get a court to order the election moved. And a lot of us thought that that was a formality, but a judge at about 7 p.m. on Monday said that it was too late and the election had to go forward. And then at around 10 p.m., DeWine and the Secretary of State announced, no, the election is postponed anyway, essentially ignoring the judge's order. And the state director of the Department of Health ordered the polls closed as a health emergency. And, you know, this obviously stirred up quite a bit of controversy, given that, you know, a court had ordered the election to go forward. Although at about 4 a.m. on Tuesday morning, so really at the last minute, the Ohio Supreme Court stepped in and said, no, we agree that the election should be postponed. So that really kind of, in the short term at least, decided the issue that the polls would not open on Tuesday morning. However, there's still kind of an open question about when the election will be held. The state Democratic Party is now suing to say, we think it should be conducted as an all-male election that ends on April 28th. The Secretary of State and the governor have still, you know, by executive decree basically said June 2nd is the date, but there's question again about whether they have the legal authority to do that. The court just said that the election should not go forward. They didn't agree that the governor had the authority to postpone it. So the legislature may also step in and try to pick a new date. So we're in a bit of limbo in Ohio, but it was really a kind of a stark example of how the crisis and adapting to the crisis can lead to some legal gray areas.
What kind of precedent does this set? I mean, it's complicated trying to weigh these different issues, but do executives, governors, the president have the authority in the United States to postpone elections? And, you know, what happens when, even if they technically don't, they insist that they do?
Right. So, you know, to get one thing out of the way, the president of the United States does not have the authority to change the federal general election date that is set by law on the Tuesday after the first Monday of November. Only an act of Congress can change that. That doesn't seem anywhere near remotely likely to happen. Of course, also hopefully these things will be, you know, things will be back to normal by November. But, you know, it is a different story on the state level. These presidential primary dates are set by the legislature on a pretty ad hoc basis. In some states, the governor or the secretary of state does have the power to change them by themselves. Most of the states that you've seen already change those dates. So five states have postponed their presidential primaries so far. Most of those states are the states where the governor has that authority. Ohio was an exception, which is why it was kind of so dramatic. But obviously, I think defying a court order, even though the Ohio Supreme Court eventually stepped in and agreed with DeWine, that was a dicey situation, and, you know, raises a very interesting philosophical question about when the rule of law is more important and when maybe public health and safety should take precedence.
Yeah, Amelia, how are you processing this conflict?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I saw in Illinois yesterday raised questions for me about whether that election should have gone forward in the way that it did. You know, I think there were, as I mentioned earlier, people were, you know, spacing out when they were waiting in line. But once you got inside, I talked to an election administrator who was saying, look, we're in a small room. We only have 9 machines. The machines are right next to each other. There is no way for us to do social distancing in this room. And so that's concerning to have seen that. And I think it does raise questions about, you know, at what point is the value of having people vote in person outweighed by serious public health concerns? On the other hand, I think what we saw in Ohio, as Nathaniel was mentioning, raises different questions about the process by which we make those decisions and who gets to make the decisions and whose authority trumps whose. You know, the idea that a governor would say, you know, seemed prepared to act contrary to a court's order, even though, you know, was citing very serious, pressing public health concerns, that's a potentially alarming situation if we start getting into some of these separation of powers disputes where a court says one thing, a governor says something different, who prevails? I mean, you know, we'll see what happens.
That's a constitutional crisis, right? That is literally a constitutional crisis.
Textbook, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we'll see what happens in Ohio as this legal fight continues to play out. But, you know, that was the thing that was really sort of alarming to me. Not so much the idea that an election would be postponed, but that we would, you know, sort of be making these decisions and that there would be genuine conflicts between different branches of government about how to proceed. And obviously the courts don't have enforcement power. So if the governor decides that he's going to move ahead, like he's going to, you know, he's going to be able to do that. The courts can't really stop him. And that was the thing that really sort of raised some alarm bells to me in what happened in Ohio.
Yeah, Amelia, obviously, I think the last minute nature of the Ohio decision was a big problem. Obviously, the situation was evolving very quickly. And, you know, DeWine probably couldn't have postponed the election the previous week, as would have been ideal. But, you know, the fact that it was still up in the air, you know, late into the night on Monday, I think, you know, would have created confusion for voters, for poll workers about whether they were going to show up if the election had gone ahead. In addition, you know, I think you have to think about, you know, this was a relatively, you know, the Democratic primary is relatively non-competitive, but what if it were, you know, what if this could actually have an effect on the election? What if, you know, we had a situation where maybe DeWine himself was facing a competitive election in a crisis like this and postponed the election? Then you would have serious concerns about whether this was an abuse of power. So there are no easy answers, I'm afraid.
This is maybe a stupid question, but is there any reason to believe that Ohio was putting people more at risk by holding elections on Tuesday than any of the other three states? Why is it just Ohio that took this path and not Florida, Illinois, or Arizona?
It's an interesting question. I am not a medical expert and haven't been following the coronavirus news, especially closely, more than the average person. But I, as far as I know, Ohio hasn't had a higher incidence of those rates. I do know that Mike DeWine has been one of the most aggressive governors in the country about, you know, implementing these public safety measures. And he had been getting rave reviews actually for that before this particular, you know, back and forth. So I think that it may just be that, that DeWine was acting out of public health, you know, very aggressively, maybe too aggressively in this case.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's been so interesting about watching this crisis unfold is that the, you know, the governors have really stepped into serious leadership positions here, and they're making different decisions about how to address this. And they're sort of, you know, we're getting the guidance that you have about how many people you should be gathering with and where you should be and what's open. You know, over the past week, that has varied from state to state. And as Nathaniel mentioned, DeWine has been especially aggressive about this. Here in Illinois, Governor J.B. Pritzker said, no, the bars and restaurants are closed except for takeout, but we're going to go ahead with the election. And that was his decision as the governor. So I think what we're seeing is, you know, I haven't seen any evidence that people in Ohio were at higher risk than, say, here in Illinois, where, you know, a lot of people were planning to vote day of. I think what we're just seeing is this is a really rapidly evolving situation. Governors are having to make these decisions for their states, and they're weighing things differently and coming to different conclusions. And we're seeing that play out in real time.
Federalism, ladies and gentlemen.
Your daily civics lesson.
And Illinois, unlike Arizona or Florida, was also holding down ballot elections. I understand that Ohio was going to be holding those down ballot primaries as well, but maybe that creates even more pressure, whereas we said the Democratic primary is no longer competitive on the presidential level. There are other competitive primaries going on, right? So maybe that was a factor. But how did that play out in Illinois, Amelia?
Well, I mean, in my district, there was a very competitive state house race when I was out at precincts. It was actually funny. There were basically two contenders, and it was sort of, you know, a little lesson in Illinois politics. One of the contenders had been endorsed by the governor. One of the contenders had been endorsed by the Chicago mayor, and they've been sort of duking it out. And one of the candidates actually didn't have people out, you know, near the polls encouraging folks to vote for him because of coronavirus concerns. The other person had a lot of people out and, you know, he was just trying to stay away. But a lot of the people I talked to in line were saying, oh, you know, I want to vote for my candidate in the Democratic primary. You know, overwhelmingly, the people I talked to were voting on the Democratic side of the ballot. But a lot of people mentioned, you know, wanting to vote in this state house race. And one of the big surprises or sort of, you know, surprising results out of the election last night was actually a down ballot race, a race involving Dan Lipinski, who is in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's one of the last sort of truly centrist Democrats. He's anti-abortion rights. He didn't vote for Obamacare. And he was being challenged for the second time by Marie Newman, who is a progressive, who wanted to unseat him. And as of right now, the AP has called the race for Newman, although Lipinski has not conceded yet. And so, you know, that was a race where, you know, it was going to be close. It wasn't clear how it was going to turn out. And it was very closely watched last night. And who knows how postponing the election would have affected it.
Nathaniel, you mentioned that other states are postponing their primaries. So how does that change the calendar going forward? How long have they postponed them until?
They've postponed them, you know, a couple of months, really. The four states are Louisiana, Georgia, Kentucky, and Maryland, in addition to Ohio. And, you know, a lot of these states were ones that were scheduled to vote in the next few weeks. Puerto Rico is another, not a state, but a commonwealth that is probably going to postpone, that is scheduled to vote in the next couple of weeks. But basically, it's opening up a big hole in the calendar. Right now, it looks like April 4th is going to be our next election date. And the three states that are still voting that day are going to be vote by mail entirely or almost entirely. And then comes Wisconsin, which is really the one in-person state that hasn't postponed at this point. And then you don't have any contests until April 28th. The aforementioned, you know, Louisiana, you know, Maryland, Kentucky, they've delayed things until June. In fact, you know, it might even be Kentucky, I believe, postponed until June 23rd, which is only 3 weeks before the DNC starts, which could be logistically challenging. That's way later than delegates are supposed to be selected. So that will be interesting to watch.
Yeah. So just to wrap up on this before we go, coming back to the Democratic primary last night, there weren't any exit polls, so we can't talk specifically about demographic trends or issue trends in the same way we otherwise could. Edison conducted a phone poll in advance of voting instead of doing in-person exit polls, and that was because of the coronavirus. But were there any trends that we saw in terms of how concerned voters in either that phone poll or other polls leading up to the primaries last night about how concerned voters were about coronavirus and whether that was being factored into their decisions last night?
Yeah, so the quote-unquote exit poll of Illinois, which was really a phone poll, did ask people how concerned they were about the coronavirus, and 53% said they were very concerned, 34% said they were somewhat concerned, only 10% said they were not too concerned, and only 3% said they were not at all concerned. So it does seem to be something that is weighing on voters' minds pretty heavily, and I mean, how could it not, given how it's affecting public life? What was interesting, and you know, and granted, this is just one state, but Joe Biden won the very concerned group, 66% to 30%, whereas the somewhat concerned group was basically split between Biden and Sanders. This does jibe with other polls that I've seen that show basically nationwide, for example, that Biden is more trusted to handle like a national crisis than Sanders is. So, you know, I think, frankly, a lot of people probably see Biden's experience, especially in the Obama administration. You know, maybe they see him as more comforting, more of a leader in terms of crisis. And so, you know, if this race weren't already sewn up for Biden, I think that this crisis would probably be helping him.
All right. Well, I think on a future podcast, we're going to talk about what Sanders' path forward is now, not in terms of trying to necessarily win the Democratic nomination, but whether he gets out of the race and what his goals really are now, I think he's probably thinking more about his movement than necessarily whether he'll win the nomination. So we'll get into that on a future podcast. And we're also going to be talking more in general about elections during times of crises in America and how we balance democratic norms with a public health emergency. So look forward to that. In the meantime, though, thank you so much for joining me today, Nathaniel. Thank you.
Thanks.
And Amelia, thank you.
Thanks, Galen.
Some great insight into how elections move forward amidst the crisis. That was really nice, guys. So thanks again. My name is Galen Daruk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. And also remember to subscribe to 538 on YouTube. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.